lucky to have Melanie, and I have a feeling Melanie could explain to any of you who really want to understand emissions inventory and many other details of climate. She understands these issues, I'll say, even better than Jerry Reed, probably a lot better than Jerry Reed. So we're lucky to have Melanie, and hopefully Jerry's not listening. And I will just kick it to Melanie just to say a little, just hello to you all, and won't put her on the spot because this is, I think, her second day on the job officially. So wherever you are, Melanie, please join us.
Thanks, Anna. It's a real privilege to serve with you as the co-chair, and I'm excited to work with everyone on the council on the important tasks that are still ahead of us. I would also like to thank Jerry Reed for his leadership on these issues, both as co-chair and as DEP's commissioner. I'm sure I will miss him at least as much as the rest of you will. Changing climate conditions affect all sectors in Maine, and at a time right now when people are so divided, the process that we're engaged in is more important than ever. The working groups, as Hannah said, did a tremendous job this summer gathering and assessing information, considering the best available science, and they've now identified strategies for all of us to weigh. A great deal of work has been done, but there's a lot left to do. We have to identify actions that we can take now and recognize that our work is not going to end with the plan in 2020. DEP and other state agencies are going to implement these strategies, and we will continue working with the council to engage stakeholders and to determine next steps for future plans so that we will achieve our emission reduction goals. So like Hannah, I want to give thanks to everyone who's been participating in this process. It's a big commitment, but it's really important, and I'm looking forward to our discussions today.
Great. Thank you, Melanie. Again, great to have you. So I think everyone understands the context in which we resume our work this fall. We have a ton of work in front of us, but I will say we are continuing this work during a pandemic, an economic recession, unsettled political times. We've got wildfires burning in California. We've got the city of Portland, Maine, again, setting a record for the hottest summer on record. We have growing instability and economic distress in the US and around the world. And we know that climate is a contributing factor on many, many fronts, from flooding to high heat to storm events to the resulting public health conditions. So I think as everyone on this call knows well, the cost of doing nothing, which is actually an official part of our work, are incredibly significant. Actually today in the New York Times, there was a story about a new federal report coming out of the Trump administration warning of financial havoc coming from climate change. And I can't help, I mean, I think it's important to understand that this is coming even out of this current administration, who's sometimes been skeptical of climate. But the report, quote, says, "A world racked by frequent and devastating shocks from climate change cannot sustain the fundamental conditions supporting our financial systems," concluded the report, "managing climate risk in the financial system." This was requested by the Commodity Futures Trading Commission and does not sound like a highly liberal group, and it's set to release this morning. So I think everyone who is here and on this call and participating in this process on both sides of the political aisle understands the stakes of our work and how important it is. So just, Cassie, put that slide back up. I just want to kind of ground us in where we are in terms of a time frame of our work. So just for those of you who are observing or have been busy this summer, to remind you of where we are now in the fall process, and we are in the kind of almost in the final leg of this mission of the Maine Climate Council, but probably the most important and difficult part, which is making decisions about what strategies are going to be in the final climate action plan, making sure they're the right strategies, making sure they get us on the path of the emissions reductions that we are required to meet by law, making sure that they are implementable, fundable, and they are actionable. So we are now in the process where the working groups have done a ton of work. Over the summer, we've added data, we've added modeling, a cost-benefit analysis, an equity audit, which is almost to us. We are working on an economic overlay for the clean energy economy for this group, but we are in the point where the decisions come back to the Maine Climate Council. It is now up to all of us to decide how we are going to put these strategies together for a final action plan. Next slide. So just again, this is something I think everyone understands well, that the two targets that we are required to meet, our time frame, the requirement of carbon neutrality by 2045. And I think the bottom line is really the most important. How do we ensure that Maine people, industries, and communities are resilient to the impacts of climate change? We are again starting to see the impacts of climate in our state, the impacts on our fisheries, on our forests, on our agriculture sector. We know that climate is in Maine and around the world most likely to threaten and impact those who are least able to manage it. And that sort of highlights the importance of our equity work this summer. Sarah on my team is gonna give an overlay of where these projects stand and how the Climate Council can really dig into this work. But again, I am just incredibly proud to work with all of you. And I would say that it is now up to us through these two meetings to really understand the strategies that have been brought to us. Through the month of October, we will be in a decision-making stance. We will really have the challenges of deciding what we can handle, what Maine people what will work for the state of Maine, and how we make this plan as aggressive as possible to meet the challenges of this time. So with that, I'm gonna pass it back to Sarah Curran, who's gonna walk you through a presentation of the framework that we've put together. Again, taking all the incredible work of the six working groups and the Science and Technical Committee, and really starting to fold them together so that we don't have seven different reports and four different analysis from consultants, but starting to put it all together into a really consolidated package. So I'll pass it to Sarah. And again, I thank especially Sarah on my team for all her incredible work.
Thanks, Hannah. Good morning, everyone. My name is Sarah Curran, and I'm a senior analyst in the Governor's Office of Policy, Innovation in the Future, and helping to support the work of the Maine Climate Council. I want to explain a little bit more about the draft strategy framework and the new information that our presentations are going to highlight today. At the June Climate Council meeting, the six working groups presented their recommended strategies to the Maine Climate Council. And those strategies were developed over many months by diverse groups of stakeholders with expertise and experience in their topic areas. The draft strategy framework builds on the strategies that the working groups proposed. And as Hannah said, it starts to move us from having six individual reports to having one action plan for Maine. And next slide, please, Cassie. So the draft strategy framework we're going to present here today is a draft. It's presented to the Climate Council by staff, and it includes the strategies proposed by the six working groups in summary form and incorporated into consolidated themes. The draft strategy framework is organized into two parts. Excuse me. Part one, reduce Maine's greenhouse gas emissions, and part two, prepare for climate change impacts. The draft strategy framework also incorporates highlights from several additional analyses conducted over the last several months, the evaluation of the costs and benefits of the various recommended strategies, a summary of public input surveys, and a report for strengthening Maine's clean energy economy. These documents are all available on the Climate Council website at maine.gov/future. And the equity assessment that was mentioned earlier is currently being finalized, and we will be able to include that in the next draft as well. So again, the purpose of the framework is to start to move us from the six working group reports to one climate action plan for Maine, and to highlight new information that we think will be helpful to your decision making. We haven't changed the substance from the working group reports, but we have reorganized the recommendations into six strategies. This is a draft to be discussed, improved, and agreed upon by the council. Next slide, please. The draft strategy framework is built around four goals. Goal one, create jobs and economic opportunity. Goal two, reduce Maine's greenhouse gas emissions. Goal three, prepare Maine residents, businesses, and communities for climate change impacts. And goal four, ensure that Maine's climate strategies are equitable. Maine has adopted some of the country's most ambitious climate and energy goals, and we can achieve those goals while creating jobs and growing a more diverse, sustainable, and equitable economy. Next slide, please. So today we'll be discussing part one of the draft strategy framework. It includes the strategies to reduce Maine's greenhouse gas emissions. Strategy A, bring the future of transportation to Maine. The strategy includes actions such as increasing electric vehicle use, reducing emissions from current gas and diesel engines, and reducing vehicles' miles traveled. Strategy B is to modernize Maine's buildings, and this includes, for example, improving the design and construction of new buildings, promoting climate-friendly building products such as mass timber and wood fiber insulation made in Maine, transitioning to cleaner heating and cooling systems, and weatherizing existing homes and businesses. Strategy C, drive innovation to reduce carbon emissions in Maine's energy and industrial sectors, includes ensuring adequate, affordable, clean energy supply to meet our energy and climate goals, initiating a stakeholder process that will make recommendations for how to modernize Maine's electric grid, energy systems, and policies while ensuring it is done efficiently and affordably, and developing and implementing new financing options. Part one of the draft strategy framework includes many of the recommendations from three working groups: transportation, buildings, and energy. And those strategies related to adaptation from those groups have been moved to part two of the strategy framework. And next slide, please, Cassie. So next week on September 16th, we'll present and discuss part two of the draft strategy framework. And that includes the strategies proposed to prepare for climate change impacts, build healthy and resilient communities, invest in climate-ready infrastructure, and protect Maine's environment, our natural resource economies, and promote natural climate solutions. And again, this is a draft strategy framework, and we're looking forward to getting all of your feedback and suggestions on how we've organized this. Next slide, please. So in addition to the draft strategy framework, I also want to briefly introduce some of the new analyses for this meeting. First is an evaluation of the costs and benefits of the various recommended strategies. The analysis by Eastern Research Group and Synapse Energy Economics includes four volumes. Volume one, vulnerability mapping, is a mapping analysis that identifies the communities, geographies, and economic sectors that are most vulnerable to climate change impacts in Maine. Volume two, the cost of doing nothing analysis, includes estimates of losses that the state of Maine and its citizens could incur if the state does not take action to prevent or prepare for climate change. The cost of not adapting to a changing climate is large and will accelerate over time, with flooding serving as the largest overall threat. Volume three, Maine emissions analysis. This report provides an energy use and emissions baseline based on our current policies, as well as an assessment of options for meeting Maine's energy needs, allowing economic growth, and reducing greenhouse gas emissions. And then finally, volume four, the economic analysis of adaptation and mitigation strategies, provides economic analysis for the majority of the adaptation and mitigation strategies recommended by the working groups. So while we will be highlighting some aspects of these reports today in the presentations, we recognize that many Climate Council members might have questions about the approach and the findings. So we will also be scheduling a webinar opportunity in the coming weeks directly with Synapse and ERG so that you can ask them questions about the reports directly. Next slide, please. The second report I want to highlight is a summary of the public input surveys that were conducted over the summer. More than 4,400 individuals provided input through feedback surveys on the website climatecouncil.maine.gov. They were invited to learn about the impacts of climate change on the state, read the strategies recommended by the working groups, and provide feedback through a series of short surveys. Numerous organizations helped us to amplify the message, and staff conducted more than 20 outreach presentations this summer as well. Residents from almost three quarters of Maine zip codes provided feedback, and the public input survey built on the stakeholder engagement that was conducted as part of the working group processes to develop the draft recommendations. And those processes included public meetings, calls, surveys, and individual organizational input as well. Staff and working group members have also been conducting webinar presentations to groups of stakeholders. We recognize that some communities may be harder to reach, and so we are continuing to work with key partners to reach groups that may be underrepresented in the climate process and or experience disproportionate impacts, such as lower income and rural residents, older adults, tribal communities, people of color, and new Mainers. So for example, we've been working with Ambassador Dana to get tribal feedback on the strategies under consideration, and with Council Member Lori Parham to ensure we hear from Maine's older adults. Next slide, please. Third, the draft strategy framework references the executive summary of the draft report Strengthening Maine's Clean Energy Economy, which will be released in mid-September by the Governor's Energy Office and the Governor's Office of Policy Innovation in the future. In order to better understand the benefits, impacts, challenges, and opportunities associated with advancing Maine's clean energy economy, with a particular focus on workforce needs, GEO and GOPIF have distributed a clean energy economy survey, and the target respondents are companies and organizations that are part of Maine's energy sector or are actively pursuing work in Maine's energy sector. Responses to the survey are expected in mid-September and will be included in the final version of this report, which will be shared with you as well. Next slide, please. I also want to highlight a few updates that the Science and Technical Committee has made to their final report on the impacts of climate change on the state of Maine, in particular, their recommendation for sea level rise. The Science and Technical Committee recommends that the Maine Climate Council commit to managing for 1.5 feet of relative sea level rise by 2050 and 3.9 feet of sea level rise by the year 2100. Additionally, the committee recommends that the Climate Council consider preparing to manage for 3 feet of relative sea level rise by 2050 and 8.8 feet of sea level rise by 2100. Their findings will be discussed further as part of next week's meeting on part two, preparing for climate change impacts. Next slide, please. Finally, the equity assessment of the working group recommendations, which is an analysis by the University of Maine's George Mitchell Center for Sustainability Solutions, is currently being finalized and will be shared with the Climate Council in the coming weeks. This report analyzes how the draft strategies ensure the equitable distribution of the benefits of climate protection efforts and address inequitable burdens created by climate change and the policies designed to alleviate it. In closing, today we will focus on part one of the draft strategy framework. It includes the strategies to reduce Maine's greenhouse gas emissions. Next week's meeting will focus on part two, preparing for climate change impacts. All of the additional information for today's meeting, all those reports are available on the Climate Council website at maine.gov/future, and we will be sending out additional materials ahead of next week's meeting as well. Thank you, and I look forward to the discussion today.
Thank you, Sarah. That's fantastic. What a great presentation. So folks, we have, and Cass, you can go ahead and drop the slides off for a moment. We've got just about 5-10 minutes. If folks have some very burning, clarifying questions they'd like to ask Sarah about that presentation, or Hannah, Melanie, we can do that right now. Remember, probably the easiest way to do questions, folks, is with the in-Zoom raise your hand function. If you're having a hard time with that, it's underneath the list of participants on the right-hand side of your screen. You can also unmute your mic and shout out too, but it's just a little more organized if we can use the hand raise. Also, I'm gonna ask Sophia to put a link in the chat for panelists right now for some shared note-taking, because we won't have time to do everyone's questions and comments right now because we wanna switch gears into the presentations quickly. So we're gonna have a note-taking template for Climate Council members. It'll be in the chat in just a second. Representative Lydia, why don't you go ahead, please?
Thank you. A clarifying question on the governor's energy office report versus the energy working group. What is the relationship between those two things?
Good question, Representative Bloom. So the part of the overall Climate Council legislation requires us to do a clean energy economy report. And obviously, I think we all in this time of economic recession want to best connect some of the climate solutions with job creation. And obviously there's, I think we all understand there's many overlays there. So the clean energy economy report is a staff project that we're gonna bring back to the council for review and approval. And it kind of overlays the entire climate plan. Melissa, who is part of the governor's energy office and was also a staff member to the energy working group, is helping to take the lead on this with Dan Burgess. But I think that, so it's separate from the energy working group. They are certainly a group of experts that will ask for their feedback before it's completed, but it is a separate report to the council.
Thanks. Thank you. Are there other clarifying questions or comments folks want to make before we switch gears and look at some of this content? Other doubts?
I just want to also just recognize that for all the council members, Sarah did a great job summarizing. You received all this information via email for the public. It's also, again, available on our website. But we do want to recognize that this is a ton of information. And I think our process today is really to get people to start thinking about it, to think about the things you want to go back and read. We recognize that Climate Council members and the public will not be able to read every single detail, but I just want to make sure that you do look at the executive summary of the analysis from Eastern ERG, as well as the framework that Sarah sent along. I think all the documents are helpful, but in the next couple of weeks, take the time to read those, because I think it is among the most important information. So any of you who have read it all, I won't call you all right now, and I'll give you a large gold star, but just recognizing there is a ton of information. It's important information, but we are trying as staff to kind of put it together in a way that is at least manageable for busy Climate Council members, because we know that you all have a lot going on.
Other clarifying questions, comments? Council members, there's a chat from Sophia in the chat with a Google Doc, and I encourage you to click on that and write down questions or comments you have as you go along here. That document has two tabs. We'll be working for now in this initial set of queries on the front first tab. Okay, great. Now, speaking of a lot of information and curating that information, what you're about to hear are three presentations where staff in Hannah's office and also in the Governor's Energy Office have tried to consolidate down and curate some of the most important information that we've been gleaning over the summer through these reports that Sarah mentioned. So what we're going to do, and these are going to be quick hit presentations of about 10 minutes each, and we're going to do the three that Sarah mentioned that we're talking about today around emissions reductions, and then we're going to listen to or hear from a couple of you just some initial reflections about what all this means for our work and over the next month and a half, 2 months, and then after that we'll take a break and actually have a conversation in smaller groups. Okay, so the first presentation is going to be about transportation, and Taylor Labreck, who many of you remember as being a critical staff person on the transportation working group, is going to walk us through this new strategy around transportation and what we've been learning over the summer with these various pieces of information that have come out. So I'll turn it over to Taylor to lead us through this first presentation, then we'll switch gears into the other two. So Taylor, please take it away, and the floor is yours.
Great, thanks, David. Hi, everyone, I am Taylor Labreck, and as Sarah mentioned, I will be taking the recommendations that the working groups presented in June and incorporating the new information that we've received since then. I know you've heard this many times, but it's worth saying it again. Transportation is responsible for 54% of Maine's greenhouse gas emissions. It's the most of any sector, making emissions reduction in this sector critical to meeting our state emission reduction goals. This map shows transportation emissions across the state. Red indicates higher emissions, orange and yellow are medium, and green is low emissions. As you can see, most of the miles are driven in the southern half of the state, along the coast, in the I-95 corridor. The strategy bringing the future of transportation to Maine focuses on the Transportation Working Group's recommendations around mitigation. including increasing electric vehicle use, which involves equitable incentives and expansion of electric vehicle charging infrastructure. Reducing emissions from current gas and diesel engines through strategies including voluntary participation in EPA SmartWay and the expansion of alternative fuels. Reducing vehicle miles traveled through the expansion of telework and teleservice opportunities, expanding public transit and supporting development in priority areas, which would facilitate walking and biking. And finally, exploring funding options for transportation needs and emission reduction. Next slide, please. So if we take a quick look back at the Synapse modeling from June, it suggests that emissions reduction is possible in Maine's transportation sector. This graph represents the trajectory of carbon dioxide emissions, which include the baseline or current policy scenario, three modeling scenarios, T1, T2, and T3. And the primary lever that Synapse used was electrification, and it alone can achieve substantial emission reduction. Of the scenarios, T1 relies the most on aggressive electrification. T2 also relies on aggressive electrification, but it also incorporates increased fuel efficiency and reduced vehicle miles traveled. T3 assumes less aggressive electrification, and it's still able to meet the emission reduction goals using a combination of low carbon fuels, aggressive reduction in vehicle miles traveled, and increased fuel efficiency. I'll now move through the recommendations from the working group and highlight the major updates that we've observed. Next slide, please. So to encourage the adoption of electric vehicles across the state, Mainers need a reliable and robust charging infrastructure system, along with incentives to support electric vehicle purchase. The cost-benefit reflects our best understanding of what is to come. As technology advances, issues such as vehicle range and the cost of batteries will likely be resolved, and electric vehicles will then become more available and affordable. The cost-benefit analysis for this strategy considers the higher cost of battery electric vehicles over conventional vehicles, along with the potential need for an at-home charging unit. They also consider that maintenance and charging costs are lower for electric vehicles. The benefits of electrification include reduced emissions along with the associated market and social benefits. If Maine provided subsidies to enable the consumers of light and heavy-duty vehicles to break even within 10 years in 2030, the benefits would outweigh the costs. By 2050, no subsidy would be needed to break even in 10 years. Next slide, please. The working group recognized the equity concerns around the high prices of electric vehicles and suggested the consideration of subsidies for used electric vehicles, increased subsidies for low-income households, and electric bikes. Electric vehicles are one of the more favorable strategies put forward by the Transportation Working Group, with just over 82% of respondents indicating that it's either a great fit or a good fit for their community. There was concern around the viability of this strategy in rural areas of the state and around vehicle costs. Next slide. While Mainers make the transition to electric vehicles, we will need to reduce our emissions in other ways too to assist that effort. Emissions can be reduced in the short term through the use of low carbon fuels, increased fuel efficiency, and reduction in vehicle miles traveled. A cost-benefit analysis was conducted for reducing the number of miles that people travel, which includes supporting the development of heat infrastructure, expanding public transportation that is easily accessible and climate-friendly, and expanding opportunities for telework and teleservices through broadband expansion. This action is especially of interest given the recent uptick in teleservices due to the COVID-19 pandemic. Broadband expansion is also key to the state's 10-year economic strategy and the COVID-19 Economic Recovery Committee. Benefits of reducing vehicle miles traveled include better air quality, health, cost savings, safety, and time. The analysis suggests that a 10% decrease in on-road transportation emissions from driving fewer miles could result in a decrease of nearly 180,000 metric tons of carbon dioxide each year. Next slide, please. The working group recognized that many of these strategies could be implemented in a way that help the aging rural population have access to transportation options, along with expanded access to telemedicine and other services through broadband expansion. The public identified reducing emissions from gas and diesel engines as the most favorable strategy put forward by the Transportation Working Group, with nearly 83% of respondents deeming it either a great fit or a good fit for their community. Enhanced public transportation, reduced commuting, and decreased vehicle miles traveled were all surveyed separately, and all were viewed favorably, with 77 to 80% of respondents deeming them a great fit or a good fit for their community. Respondents showed particular interest in biking and walking infrastructure and broadband expansion. They voiced concern around the viability of reducing vehicle miles traveled in rural areas. Next slide, please. The transition to a lower emission transportation sector will have positive impacts for Maine, that's clear. However, it does not come without a cost. You heard in June how Maine's transportation infrastructure is chronically underfunded. The annual transportation funding shortfall is $232 million and has only been worsened due to the pandemic. Maine must continue to explore different revenue sources that will support the current and future needs, as well as transportation needs, as well as climate transportation initiatives. A cost-benefit analysis compared several funding mechanisms that were proposed by the Transportation Working Group, including a fee on vehicle miles traveled, or VMT, a carbon market concept, and a fuel tax. All of the mechanisms resulted in reduced emissions and reduced air pollutants. Next slide, please. The working group recognized a number of equity concerns around implementing a new funding mechanism. The added costs for low-income households would be a real issue. Additionally, people in rural areas tend to drive further distances to get to where they need. A VMT fee or a fuel tax would disproportionately affect them. The public shared all of these concerns. A key piece of the funding mechanism will be ensuring that the funds are directed in a way that considers people who may be disproportionately impacted by the mechanism. As Melanie said, there's a great deal of work that's been done, but a lot left to do. I look forward to seeing where the Maine Climate Council takes it next. And with that, I will turn it back over to David to introduce the next speaker.
Thanks, Taylor. Fantastic. Okay. All right, let's just quickly go to the next presentation. This is gonna be about buildings and infrastructure. Brian Ambrett from Hannah Pingree's office will be leading us through a presentation somewhat similar to what Taylor just provided. So Brian, why don't you take it away?
Thank you, David, and good morning to everyone. My name is Brian Ambrett. I'm the Climate Resilience Coordinator in the Governor's Office of Policy Innovation in the Future. The modernized Maine's building strategy has 7 action areas, which include transitioning to cleaner heating and cooling systems in buildings, primarily through electric heat pumps, improving new buildings through progressively more efficient building codes, weatherizing existing buildings in Maine, which has some of the oldest housing stock in the country, using public dollars to demonstrate building efficiency benefits, requiring renewable fuels like biodiesel and renewable natural gas to make up a percentage of heating fuel sales, promoting Maine's climate-friendly forest products in building construction, and lastly, from the public health subgroup, encouraging Maine's hospitals to become carbon neutral. I'm going to discuss the first 4 of these in more detail in a moment, so let me say a few things briefly about the others. You will see on the next slide that the renewable fuel standard is an important tool to consider for reaching our 2030 emissions goals. However, just 51% of survey respondents deemed a renewable fuel standard for heating a great fit, and 13% of respondents thought it was not a good fit, among one of the strongest unfavorable responses for any working group strategy. So we clearly have work to do to communicate the benefits and the feasibility of a renewable fuel standard. The forest product sector in Maine is important both economically and for reaching our climate goals. By promoting building products like mass timber and wood fiber insulation, not only are we supporting jobs and local economies in rural areas, we can store carbon in our buildings for decades to come as well. Next slide. The graph on the right shows the modeling results of 4 potential pathways for reducing greenhouse gases in the building sector. The blue line shows our baseline with current policies. That means fulfilling the state's goal of 100,000 heat pumps by 2030, so that by 2050, 40% of households have heat pumps or legacy electric resistance heat. The baseline assumes the current renewable portfolio standard for electricity generation, and it assumes a current level of effort on weatherization that yields about 2% annual improvements across Maine's building stock. The yellow line represents a high electrification scenario, such that by 2050, 90% of homes and 90% of commercial heating loads are electrified via heat pumps. The red scenario adds aggressive weatherization. It includes the same 90% targets for electrification of heating, but it increases the level of effort on weatherizing existing buildings and models a 20% reduction in space heat energy requirements by 2050. You'll notice that this option does not diverge much from the yellow line because weatherization takes a long time for the carbon benefits to accumulate. However, we'll see in a moment that weatherization has important additional benefits for cost savings and comfort. The green scenario assumes a moderate electrification where about 60 or 70% of the statewide heating load is electrified versus 90% in the 2 previous scenarios. And it assumes a baseline weatherization improvements of about 2% per year. It replaces fossil fuels with biofuels and renewable natural gas for the remaining heating load across the state. If implemented quickly and aggressively, this option provides greater emissions reductions early in the pathway, as shown by the divergence of the green line from the yellow and the red during the middle years of 2025 to 2035. The caveat is that we would still need to go pretty hard on heat pumps to get to that 60 to 70% target for electrification of heating loads. Next slide. To give you an idea of the new information added by the economic studies and public engagement process this summer, we'll look at 3 of the actions. Transitioning to cleaner heating via electrification and heat pumps comes with several important benefits. Despite marginally higher upfront costs, both space heating and water heating by heat pumps have net lifetime savings measured in the thousands of dollars. Heat pumps eliminate high amounts of greenhouse gases over their lifetime, and the monetized benefits outweigh the costs. There are already incentive programs in place through Efficiency Maine that can be turbocharged to meet the 60 or 90% targets. Next slide. With benefits like these, it is easy to understand why heat pumps were very popular among people who responded to the building survey. However, both Efficiency Maine and the buildings work group noted the importance of ensuring that these benefits are accessible to low and moderate income households. Efficiency Maine already allocates a portion of its heat pump funding specifically for low-income households, and it has higher incentives for low and moderate income households to switch to heat pumps and other high-efficiency heating systems. Along with the standard incentives, these equity-focused programs will need to be expanded to make certain that the benefits of savings and comfort are accessible by all in Maine. Next slide. Improving the efficiency of new buildings and weatherizing existing buildings carry many of the same benefits as electrification. The lifetime heating cost savings outweigh the upfront costs of building to tighter building codes or for weatherizing in an existing home, even when you exclude the weatherization incentive. The carbon reductions are very high and home comfort is greatly improved. Weatherization additionally carries a benefit cost ratio greater than one and already has an incentive program in place. The challenge is that there are more than 500,000 homes and apartment units in Maine, and less than 5% of them have been weatherized. Weatherization can be messy, expensive, and labor intensive, so the carbon benefits will take a good deal of time and effort to realize. Weatherization's uphill road underscores the importance of making sure new construction meets higher standards so that we don't add to the number of buildings that need to be weatherized in the future. On the plus side, the volume of weatherization that needs to happen creates a huge demand for labor, and several working groups recommended a Maine Climate Corps or Green Jobs program to fill that kind of need. Next slide. With Maine's northern climate and old housing stock, it is not surprising that weatherization had the highest favorability among survey respondents of any building's actions. A public commenter made the important link to equity, encouraging the council to consider that low-income housing and senior housing be at the top of the priority list for new or expanded programs. Next slide. State and local governments can play a leadership role in demonstrating the benefits, especially the lifetime savings from strategies like these. While not an example of weatherization or electrification, the town of Bristol financed solar arrays at its transfer station and its consolidated school. In addition to eliminating 48 tons of carbon pollution each year, the project sparked local interest and discussion. A grassroots effort is now underway to build a community solar farm that town residents can buy into and go solar without needing solar panels on their own rooftops. A town resident even stepped up to host the project and finance the costs. Lead by example projects are important for lowering public expenses, for demonstrating feasible technologies, especially for increasing the visibility of the benefits of clean and efficient energy choices. And with that, I'll thank you for listening and turn it back to David.
Thanks so much, Brian. Fantastic. Okay. The last one is what would formerly have been the Energy Working Group. And here, Melissa Winnie will be giving a presentation that speaks to the new information we have and the way we've consolidated the previous group's work into this new strategy. So Melissa, let me turn it over to you and let you go ahead, please.
Great. Thank you, David. Good morning, I'm Melissa Winnie, Energy Policy Analyst with the Governor's Energy Office. As was mentioned, the next strategy is to drive innovation to reduce carbon emissions in Maine's energy and industrial sectors. This includes the action areas of ensuring adequate, affordable, and clean energy supply, reduce emissions in Maine's industrial sector, encourage combined heat and power facilities that are highly efficient, investigate and potentially develop and implement financing options necessary to meet our goals, and initiate a stakeholder process to make recommendations to modernize Maine's electric grid, energy systems, and associated planning and policies. Next slide. As a reminder, Synapse modeled two electric scenarios, a sustained policy scenario and decarbonization. For both of these, vehicle miles traveled, weatherization, and energy efficiency remained constant. The sustained policy scenario includes an 80% RPS by 2030, as is currently in statute, but lower transportation and heating electrification, and therefore lower electrical load. The decarbonization scenario includes achievement of 100% RPS by 2050, and high transportation and heating electrification, resulting in a greater electric load. Figure 2 on the right shows charts that illustrate emissions associated with the sustained policy scenario in the left chart and emissions associated with the decarbonization scenario on the right. As you can see, the decarbonization scenario on the right results in lower overall energy emissions, closer to the state's 2050 emission reduction target. While this strategy overall includes industrial sector action areas, this modeling does not include additional industrial emissions reductions. Next slide. The first action area is to ensure that Maine's electric grid is clean, affordable, and able to meet future energy needs as Maine pursues beneficial electrification. Benefits of this action area include reduction in carbon dioxide emissions, along with associated market and social benefits of reduced emissions, including major health benefits. Additionally, this action area is poised to create significant jobs and economic benefits. Costs were analyzed using the levelized cost of energy, which is used to consistently compare electricity generation methods and to estimate the cost per unit of electricity generated over the entire lifespan of the generating plants. And that includes both capital and operating costs. While the analysis found varying ranges of cost estimates, overall they found that renewable energy sources can provide energy at a cost comparable to non-renewable sources. And as renewable energy technology advances, the cost of renewable energy is expected to continue decreasing. The Energy Working Group noted that any processes, procurements, and policies pursued in association with this action area should include cost and equity considerations. And energy-related programs that support low to moderate income households should continue to provide services and be expanded as needed. This action area received high support from energy survey respondents. Next slide. Analysis shows that the decarbonization pathway reduces Maine's emissions, as we saw. And this table shows the monetized benefits of this reduction for consumption-based emissions, which consider New England emissions associated with Maine's electricity sales, and production-based emissions, which include emissions from generation located in Maine only. This analysis uses the market value of carbon and the minimum and maximum estimates of the social value of carbon. The market value is the projected carbon price for the Regional Greenhouse Gas Initiative, or REGGI, and the social cost is a broader depiction of the cost of carbon to society, including considerations of emission reduction benefits such as increased agricultural productivity, improved human health, and prevented damages from increased flooding, as some examples. Based on the market value of carbon, the decarbonization scenario results in average monetized emission reduction benefits of around $100 million between 2020 and 2050. When considering the social cost of carbon, analysis found the decarbonization scenario provides an average monetized emission reduction benefit ranging from around $900 million to $2.7 billion. Next slide. The next action area is to encourage highly efficient combined heat and power facilities, or CHP. Maine has 42 CHP facilities with a combined capacity of over 668 megawatts. And CHP facilities recycle the heat byproduct from power generation and use it for heating, cooling, and industrial processes in nearby facilities, thus reducing emissions and redundancy. Benefits include increased efficiency, cost savings resulting in facilities that are economically beneficial in the long term, and reduced emissions. One study found that CHP facilities can reduce emissions of carbon dioxide by over 21%. In terms of specific cost-benefit analysis for Maine, quantitative modeling of replacing current infrastructure with CHP was outside the scope of the current analysis, but ERG recommends a benefit cost and cost-effectiveness analysis for a selection of the facilities located in Maine, and that may help with future decision-making and a better understanding of the costs and benefits resulting from CHP. Equity considerations include that improved efficiency and thus associated benefits to the electric grid, such as reduced peak demand or capacity needs, could result in benefits for all Maine ratepayers. Procurements for such projects must be competitive in order to elicit the least cost prices for greatest ratepayer benefits. Based on public comment, continued efforts should be made to provide education on CHP and the potential costs and benefits of such projects. Overall, less than half of the energy survey respondents thought this strategy was a good fit for their particular communities. Next slide. This action item to accelerate the decarbonization of industrial use and processes included two steps. One is expanding funding for industrial energy efficiency program offerings through Efficiency Maine Trust, and to study, propose, and support long-range plans for industrial decarbonization. Analysis included literature review that found an estimated 20 to 50% of all energy input to industrial facilities is rejected as heat. Basic heat recovery is one example could improve this greatly in Maine, resulting in greater energy efficiency and lower emissions. Benefits of improved industrial processes include reduction in emissions and potential cost savings. Additional benefits can be experienced in fuel switching to main-based production sources that may result in stabilized energy costs and creation of main jobs. Additional modeling would be needed to cover different fuel types over various timeframes that could help Maine estimate several specific benefits and costs for various fuel and system switching scenarios. In terms of equity considerations, this action area may provide opportunities for job creation and economic growth, particularly in rural areas of the state, would help to disperse benefits to all communities in Maine. Equity should also be considered in ensuring large industrial users have access to efficiency funds, particularly if they are contributing money to that fund. Maine public responses to this recommendation were generally neutral, and comments indicated that in areas where there were not high numbers of industrial facilities, there was less acknowledgement of the strategy being a good fit for an individual's particular community. Next slide. The next action area is to investigate, develop, and implement new financing options necessary to meet Maine's clean energy and climate-related targets. Achieving Maine's clean energy and climate goals will require additional capital to finance clean energy projects and to fund energy-related programs. And the more affordable these investments are, the more cost-effective and robust Maine's transition to a clean energy economy will be. This action area will likely be met through a variety of existing and new funding sources and mechanisms, both private and public. Funding helps provide the means for strategies and development to take place, potentially at lower costs, and result in associated benefits for the state. ERG did not provide specific cost-benefit analysis for this recommendation. The Energy Working Group recognized some equity considerations around financing. One example is inclusion of programs to provide grants, low or zero interest loans, or credit enhancements for low to moderate income households or public housing. And examples of these types of programs can be found in other states. Next slide. The final action area is to initiate a stakeholder process managed by the Governor's Energy Office in coordination with the Maine Public Utilities Commission. This process would examine and provide recommendations regarding transformation and planning of Maine's electric sector to address and facilitate the recommendations of the Climate Council, including beneficial electrification, which may require expansion and investment in the electric grid. While this process does not in and of itself result in carbon emission reductions or related benefits, the process is essential to ensure that beneficial electrification and other clean energy and climate goals are accomplished in the most efficient and effective way. Equity considerations were included by the Energy Working Group, both within the topic area of equitable and efficient cost allocation that would be examined through this process, as well as ensuring the process itself is transparent and allows for easily accessible public engagement. Next slide. Finally, as was mentioned earlier, in an effort to ensure the greatest economic and workforce benefits for the state, the Governor's Energy Office and Governor's Office of Policy Innovation in the Future are developing a plan to strengthen Maine's clean energy economy. Recent clean energy policies and programs have set the foundation for significant growth in the clean energy sector, which can play a key role in Maine's economic recovery efforts. Job growth and economic development opportunities within the clean energy economy can be realized with further targeted efforts and support. Through these concerted efforts to develop Maine's clean energy economy, the state can move forward with the creation of local jobs, strong economic recovery and sustained development, climate change mitigation, and improved public health. The Clean Energy Economy Executive Summary is again included in your materials, and the report will be finalized in early October 2020.
Melissa, by the way, is also leading the drafting of that Clean Energy Report, the Clean Energy Economy Report. So thanks, Melissa, for that. I just want to pause to say Maine clearly is blessed with some very, very capable professional staff in what used to be Augusta, but now we're all in our own homes. Thanks everyone for those great presentations. Clearly folks are trying to tee it up so that you can do some thinking as a Climate Council and you can start to make some decisions. Okay, we're gonna hear from some of you now as some initial reactions, just five of you. And what I'm gonna ask, and we've done this, if you remember from June, I asked folks to turn off your cameras. So unless you're Hannah Pingree or Melanie, or one of the five folks we've asked, Michael Stoddard, Dan Burgess, and Kate Dempsey, Commissioner Bruce Van Note, and Matt Marks, go ahead and turn off your camera now. It'd be a great time. Just go ahead and turn off your camera. You can also stand up from your chair right now and do that seventh inning stretch as well, once you have your camera off. And then if folks want to really clean up their screen, on any person's name that has their camera off, you can click on those three little dots, and at the bottom, it'll towards the bottom, it says hide non-video participants, right? So anybody who has their video turned off, you can see those three little dots you can click on, and one of the menu options is hide non-video participants. And it should happen what I have, which is just the folks right on the screen. Okay, great. Hannah, do you want to lead us off in this panel, please?
Sure. Again, just huge thank you to the staff presentations. I've gotten several texts from several of you saying how lucky we are. So just to echo David's comments, we have a great group of staff, but now it is up to you all as Climate Council members. So I've asked this panel for some kind of quick reactions. I see this group as sort of people with expertise in building energy transportation issues. So I really want to hear their comments as Maine Climate Council members. But I think for all of us, as we move into the next phase for smaller group discussions, David's going to provide a couple framing comments. But, you know, big picture for the council, the questions and sort of this is what we're trying to look at, the charts and graphs and the modeling exercises to think about is, does this do the strategies that we just heard about get us to the legal targets that we're supposed to reach for 2030? Our mandate as a council is to create a plan that gets us on a path to meet 2030 targets and eventually 2050 targets. I think I'm looking at Michael Stoddard when I say this, but what are the most cost-effective strategies to implement for a state that's strapped during an economic recession? What are the strategies that require immediate action and urgency? We heard about this and we'll continue to discuss it, but how do we ensure that equity in our strategies and their implementation, whether this be for an older Mainer living in a remote area of Aroostook County, a tribal member living in a coastal community, or for new Mainers living in substandard housing in Lewiston, how do we ensure equity? How do we ensure implementation speaks to the times that we're living in? Affordability for people struggling in a recession and economic rebuilding, but at the same time remaining ambitious and aggressive to meet the challenge. I think we'll talk about this a little bit here, but you know, it's everything from messaging and education, thinking about the phases of implementation, what first and how. Funding and creative financing, it's gonna be a major area of focus for this council. How do we pay for the strategies that we're proposing? How do we ensure there's a workforce available to do the work? A lot of this is about implementation by skilled workers. We know we have those workers in Maine, but do they need require training? How do we make sure that they can have good paying jobs to do this kind of work? And then I think really this panel is a good one on this one, but the practical and political thinking, how do we convince Mainers through incentives, through policies, through the, you know, everything from building codes to the larger policies, how are we gonna convince people to take action, convince them to make change? These are probably the most significant challenges for this council and this state. Many of these items do require people starting to think about the world in a new way. I think that people are starting to take these actions and change, but there's still a long ways to go. So again, I think we have a panel here of experts who have already thought a lot about this, who are implementing it on the ground. And we're gonna ask them to go through and sort of make some comments to lead us into our next conversation. So with that, I'm gonna pass it just for a couple minutes. David, do you want to leave this? Should I start by handing it off? You're on mute.
Thank you. Yes, I was going to say we've got just 25 minutes, and so why don't we go with you first, Michael Stoddard, to talk a little bit about the buildings. And as Hannah says, really help us think as a climate council what we need to focus on in the next month and a half, given where we're at, the new information we have. What's feasible for us as a climate council with all those awesome considerations that we've been hearing about? What do we really need to focus on as a climate council in the next month and a half? Michael, why don't you go first and just take a few minutes and riff on that, please.
Okay, thanks, David. I'll give it a shot, and thanks, Hannah. And I wanna add my congratulations to the staff who did an awesome job this morning. 2 years ago, that would have been impossible because none of them were here working for the state, and we're lucky to have them. I think it's not overly complicated what's going on in buildings. We're a little bit fortunate in that sense that the greenhouse gases are coming from burning oil primarily. And so the questions are, how can we do less of that? We can either make our buildings more better weatherized and insulated so we don't need to heat them as much, or we can switch to other kinds of fuels that don't emit as much greenhouse gases as oil does. And we're kind of lucky that we also, because we live in Maine and it's cold for a lot of the year, we do a fair amount of this, thinking about how we're going to cut down on our heating costs. So it's not like this is a brand new challenge for us. We've been thinking about this and working on this, all of us collectively, for decades, for centuries. And so I think we're in an okay spot. We know what the tools are. The most cost-effective opportunity is with new construction. And so, you know, the legislature had their eyes on this a couple of years ago in 2019. They did adopt new building codes and said, we got to keep updating these building codes every few years. So I think we're on the right track. We have the regulatory framework to do this, but our compliance with building codes is really has really sort of atrophied over the last 10 years or so. And I think that's something that we as a council should be focusing on, ways that we can, some recommendations we could make to help build that up so that compliance is a more regular thing. And also looking down the line and setting some targets. So one of the things you see in the recommendations from the buildings working group was a target. And the target was set pretty far out in time at 2035. So that's a pretty good long lead time to get to a very aggressive target. But we should do something like that. And I think as a council, we should pick a target that we think is feasible. And then we should also focus on other things like training and maybe incentives. The beauty of regulations is you don't need to come up with cash to pay for them as a state program. They may cost something, but as Melissa mentioned, or Brian mentioned, this is particularly cost-effective option. So you're gonna save more money than it costs. So I think this is one that's kind of an easy one, and we should focus on how we can make it better, what the current framework we have. The other big thing is the equipment that we use to make heat. And so you're maybe getting sick of hearing about it now, but I think we're blessed to have this new technology that is this new generation of heat pump technology that runs on electricity. There are some other options too that can complement that with modern wood heat and maybe renewable, sort of hydrogen-based fuels in the future. But the combination of these do give us some options from what we've been using for the last 100 years. And so I think that's a nice opportunity. And as you won't be surprised to hear me say, we kind of know how to do this with incentives. We're doing it now. Maine is leading the country in providing incentives for high-performance heat pumps. We just got to set appropriate targets and find the appropriate funding streams and funding amounts to do it. So there again, you know, we're lucky that that ERG did the cost effectiveness analysis and our staff was able to help with that. And it shows that across the board, these energy efficiency measures will save you more money than they cost. So that's kind of nice when one of your lead mitigation strategies is a money saver. So we should feel good about focusing our efforts on that. I don't think we need to overthink it. You know, it's weatherizing buildings, gradually switching to cleaner fuels and cleaner heating systems. And that is something that I do think as a council, we should focus on a bit. It's gonna be a little tricky to figure out if that's something we can regulate and if so, how. But I'll stop there. I think those are the high level things, are the new building codes and incentive programs for weatherizing and heating systems.
That's great. Thanks, Michael. So on the transportation, we actually have three folks because transportation is a tricky beast, as we know. It's the number one source of emissions for the state in terms of sectors. And without any particular order, although why don't I turn to the commissioner first, Commissioner Bruce Van Note, I wonder if you want to just offer a few reflections when you heard that presentation this morning. And when you think about really the dilemmas that this climate council could dive into, what's on your mind?
Thanks, David. First of all, whoever's creating the captions, if somebody could just put Bruce Van Note, Commissioner Bruce there kind of looks like Dr. Phil, and it just doesn't work for me. So I go by Bruce all the time. My first reflection was pride. I mean, Taylor is a DOT employee and she did a great job. And in the adjoining office is Joyce Taylor, who has been putting in gobs of her time towards this effort. And so that was my first thought. And then in kind of at higher levels down to kind of Google Earth from higher levels and getting down, drilling down. First is excitement, to be honest. This first time in 100 years since horse and buggy to cars that transportation is transforming right in front of our eyes. Whether it's electric or autonomous, it's change is coming and it's inevitable. And I think one of the reasons it's inevitable, and this could help on, Hannah, you were talking about packaging and that kind of stuff. People are gonna like the cars. You should do this for climate, which is, of course, existential and the reason we're all talking, but to sell, they're going to like electric cars because they're not going to break down. When you talk equity here, transportation is a huge percentage of their budget, and a car breaking down can be the same as a huge health expense, unbudgeted, everything stops, life stops kind of thing. And electric cars, by and large, don't do that. You change out the battery periodically and you lube it. There's no explosions going on under there. So I think it's good to focus on that kind of, the benefit of the car. So, and they're going to like that they're quiet. People are just going to like the cars. Of course, the second thing, and I'm inherently pragmatic, is this is challenging time. I mean, we're in the middle, public health is number one right now. That's causing budget impacts of $500 million in the general fund a year. And for us, it's, similar proportionally in the highway fund. Taylor talked about the basic needs that we're $230 million a year short. That includes having a $100 million bond every year. And that doesn't include the reduced revenues that came from COVID. So, that kind of stuff just skills. It's long-term excitement, short-term challenge kind of thing, which of course leads to the third thing, opportunities. I think there's opportunities now like ever before to create partnerships amongst various sectors. For the first time ever, it might have been induced by a accelerated exit of the legislature, but they passed a transportation bond that included something else, broadband. And it was called a connections bond because the idea obviously is that this provides connections, whether it's physically through the transportation network or electronically through high-speed internet. I think that kind of thought process is ripe and that a rising tide could float all boats here. And then lastly, is just kind of observations on approach. And I would summarize it in three kind of words, pragmatism, partnerships, and patience is, I think, what we're going to need. Looking at the report, these are just, I'm speaking for myself now, but, the T1 kind of thing that assumes kind of VMT will stay roughly level. I think that's probably more likely. In this state, we can have some targeted wins in more urban suburban areas, but that's relatively few. And I think we have to start painting pictures of, from a kitchen table perspective, what's your life look like in the future? And paint pictures like you may have two cars and one's a used electric and the other is a hybrid truck, so it's like, it's not like the challenge with this, when you look at everything that we're up against, 3/4 of the greenhouse gas emissions are from personal choices, between transportation and housing, roughly 2/3 to 3/4. So, you know, all we got to do is change where you live, what house you live in, what you drive, and where you work, and what your house. So those are tough things. So instead of making it seem like a burden, talk to the benefit. Talk to the benefit to them. You're going to have a car that can run around town that doesn't break down. You don't have to worry about that. It's quiet. Doesn't worry about that. I think VMT, the reason I think it will probably stay flat is that easy travel in Maine is actually part of our brand. People from Boston and New York, or if they decide to co-locate here, they're co-locating here because they can work here, walk to a village, bike there, and get to the mountains in an hour, or get to the coast in an hour, that kind of stuff. So I'd be looking at the T1, and we need quick wins, and there's plenty that we can do for quick wins. We're looking at right now implementing what we call a complete villages kind of initiative, where you do focus money in the village areas. I think village is an important word than urban, by the way, in Maine, between the rural and, yes, there's downtowns, but in most of Maine, it's villages. And one thing that I wondered if, whether it was, you know, I think it was missing from my perspective, again, focusing on the kitchen table. You have to think about people, the maximum price for some Mainers that they're gonna pay for a car is 10,000 bucks, used in 10,000. How are you gonna get them into something? And I didn't see regular gas hybrids as a program. It would be a 2030 strategy, not a 2050 strategy. But there's, you know, the idea that you could get people into something because in a lot of rural Maine, range anxiety is the thing. You know, until they have 300 miles of dependable electric range, they're gonna want, you know, reliability, and a hybrid could get there. So.
Bruce, I'm just going to jump in to say that that's great. I don't know if you have one more point you want to wrap up with.
No, that was it. So that must mean I'm a minute over. So sorry about that, David.
You're great. Okay. Let's go to Kate, and then we'll go to Matt. So Kate Dempsey, why don't you give us some reflections from where you sit at Nature Conservancy?
Awesome. And the Nature Conservancy has had a lot of fun working with Commissioner and his team, and with Matt Marks, who's going to be talking a lot as well. We have a lot of fun talking about culverts most days. But today we're talking about vehicle miles traveled, electrification, and thinking about funding. And as we heard from Taylor, the comments really focused on this walkable, bikeable cities, need for increased broadband, and a real concern about rural Mainers and the disconnection that we want to make sure doesn't happen. I would add that actually these three conversations this morning work really well together, and we have to think about how electrification is deployed. So I want to keep integration in this conversation, but I'm talking mostly about the transportation section. But what I really saw was interesting is that based on what the commissioner and Taylor were talking about, is that we're really at a good point for policy levers making sense. We know that policy levers, as we heard Michael talking about, can change individual behavior. And we know that people are ready to make this change, but they need the incentives to make the change to EVs, as you talked about, Commissioner. I also think there's some big opportunities for us specifically as Maine, mostly around the area of light duty passenger vehicles. And we saw from the report that electric vehicle adoption is gonna be super cost effective over the long run. We've got to think about how to make sure this climate action plan supports our rural communities and making sure that the infrastructure is there for an electrical grid. The Conservancy did a poll earlier this year that oversampled in our rural RIM counties, and it really pointed to how incentives will change people's behaviors. And I would just point out to your point, Commissioner, about people buying a vehicle 10 years from now, whatever time, you know, for a certain price, used vehicles are important here in Maine, but the urgency for us to act now is on electrification of vehicles is right this moment, because roughly half the cars sold today will remain on the road in 2035. So we like our cars, we like them to stick around, so let's get them out quickly. We have talked in the working group a lot about a regional approach. We think it makes sense to work with our states in the eastern seaboard. We know that Maine's located at the tailpipe of the Northeast, and our air quality depends on what a lot of our states do. So we need to be working with them. And we also know that, as we just heard, that a huge amount of transportation emissions do come from our visitors. So let's make sure that they're helping to pay for our reductions in emissions. The report goes into many of the co-benefits of vehicle mile travel. So I would say that I was pretty actually interested in scenario T3 because of that combination that really focuses on reductions of VMTs while supporting rural communities. Regardless, I think there needs to be some kind of framework for paying for transportation. And we have seen successful programs like the Regional Greenhouse Gas Initiative. Maine's a leader in our renewable portfolio standard, and we are all proud of the work that Efficiency Maine has done to get those dollars out to communities. I think we can replicate that. Given the state's budget shortfall, I think the general fund isn't a great option right now. We could continue borrowing, and we probably will, but that's been very targeted, and nice to see these partnerships. But I do think a regional approach is a real opportunity for us. That's it, David.
Thanks, Kate. That's wonderful. Matt, can you just introduce yourself before you speak? I forgot to do that with your colleagues.
And just Matt has my favorite bridge in all of Maine behind him.
That's cool.
The nice view.
Yeah, thanks, David. Matt Marks with Associated General Contractors, and we represent the commercial construction industry throughout Maine. It is a cool bridge. Yeah, it's a good use of recycled materials, too. We're happy about it. Assuming you want me to talk about sort of reaction to... Okay.
What do you think it means for the council in the next month and a half? Like what the council can really dig into in the next month and a half?
Yeah, and I think that's probably a good shift. Because I, you know, Taylor did a terrific job wrapping up, you know, sort of where we were and what that group did. And of course, Joyce has led this throughout the summer in very difficult times to try to get technical data across on a stream, a video stream. So the next step really is to sort of take what the basics have been for that group and sort of turn the corner and really start to discuss what can be done and what may take a little bit longer, I think. So I broke it into three things right away as we started to meet as a group, a subcommittee. The rural versus urban became real critical, and you've heard it from everybody else's reaction too. For me, I think in that sense, a couple things that were evident right away. Obviously, public transportation challenges and opportunities, but also fuel distribution, whether it be biodiesel or electric. Both those things need some extra TLC to try to figure out what's viable and what's not right away to make the most, I'd say, bang for the buck on that case. And then large frame vehicles. One thing I don't want to toss aside is, you know, my next category, sort of limitations, but Mainers are typically driving larger frame vehicles. And part of that is use because you're going to drive rural and also weather. And we really haven't had a chance to really address that as far as the market goes, because there's some limitations there for electric at this point. And then I would say on limitations, you know, current technology. We talked a little bit about what's currently available, and you heard the commissioner allude to hybrid versus, you know, straight EV and what's currently available here in Maine, but also the T&D and charging stations. And I think moving forward, that across the board, and I went through all everybody's recommendations. And, you know, that's a discussion that we need to have collectively. And I think that's an opportunity, not just for transportation, but I think in general for jobs and collaboration on the other types of recommendations that have come out. So I think that's a positive move forward. And then the production of alternative fuels. We really didn't get a chance to get into that piece. I think the Climate Council can. There's some opportunities happening in Maine, some new science, but we have some logistics there that are challenging. And I think having those experts be able to come into the council and talk about what's happening and then understand what, you know, the state may be able to do to contribute to advancing that. And then in my sector, heavy duty vehicles. We spent some time talking about the smart way technology, which I think is worth the council really going into a little bit more, but also, you know, having the realistic discussion about what it looks like for heavy duty vehicles. And we saw light duty buses and trash trucks, those kind of things that may have some electric options right away, but some of the stuff we're doing in my sector really just, there's nothing available at this point. So, and then, you know, as the one of the things that we didn't really get into was communication. You know, what is happening now within agencies that already addresses some climate challenges, whether it be the program that Joyce Taylor is running with intelligent transportation. That means, you know, moving vehicles through stoplights more efficiently, having that coordination. Those are all really positive things happening. And I think it's important that the public hear that, but also just not for climate, but the efficiency of it. It's just extremely more efficient. I think those kind of discussions are key. I'd say leftover, and I'll wrap up with this. You know, we can talk more, I think, as a committee about the job creation piece and the training and education. I think those are all great. I think logistics, of course, funding. You know, we didn't all agree on funding, but I think there are some opportunities here to where we agree on things where we can, you know, come together and try to figure out how to make, you know, what our priorities are. And then again, I think the commissioner hit on it. Mainers tend to be pretty frugal. I'm driving a car with 180,000 miles. I think the commissioner has me beat. But when you look at hybrid vehicles and the Kate's point, people are buying vehicles and they're going to last a long time. You know, how do we focus on those kind of markets where, you know, we are going to see people buying stuff that's going to be in their dooryard for quite, you know, quite a long time. So that's my immediate reaction. I think there's been a lot of crossover, which is probably a really good thing between the groups. And I think we should grab on those right away and start, you know, figuring out how we can make those work together.
Thanks, Matt. Excellent. So to wrap it up, I'll turn to Dan Burgess at the Governor's Energy Office to give us a view overall on the energy and the needs of renewable energy standards and the grid. So Dan, why don't you wrap up this panel for us?
Yeah, great. Thanks, David, and echo everyone else's comments about the incredible staff work and time that's gone into this. So thank you to everyone that has spent a lot of time and to the everyone that's kind of tuning in and for all the input we received. I mean, I think it's pretty clear that the work of our, you know, of the energy sector, as Matt was saying, really does, you know, depend or work closely with the buildings and transportation groups, right? Like the overlap is undeniable, you know, and I think we are fortunate to be in a place where we, you know, we already have a really ambitious renewable portfolio standard requirement for renewable energy that we receive. We're going to double the amount of renewable energy that we're receiving over the next 10 years to 80%, but kind of 80% of what, right, is I think the question that we need to be thinking about, and how aggressive or ambitious will we be on the buildings and transportation groups, specific on electrification. You know, some of the analysis came back, and this is what others have shown too, is it could be a doubling or tripling of the grid. But I think that really depends on how efficient we are with and forward thinking we are on some of our policies, ensuring that we're kind of maximizing the resources that we have on the grid or new resources that are being put on. I think we need to do that in the most cost-effective and affordable way as well. I mean, I think that, you know, it's a really important piece of what we're talking about. You know, I think we're seeing some of the results from some of the legislation passed last year with some of the procurements that are happening. I don't know about you all, but it's been pretty exciting to look at the newspaper over the summer and hear about all of the economic development that's happening in the renewable energy space this summer. And you know, there's more to come on that this fall. And I think, you know, we'll need to be thinking of a group of do we want to, you know, continue to do more long-term contracts? Do we want to focus on specific technologies and look at innovation? You know, whether it's offshore wind, you know, smaller distributed generation, battery energy storage or other energy storage technologies. Michael mentioned hydrogen. You know, there's a lot of innovative technologies out there that we could be thinking about and are included in some of the recommendations. And I think, you know, overall, the point about the economic benefit, particularly in light of the pandemic, I think is, for me, kind of the jobs workforce piece is going to be a big part and should be at the forefront of our mind as we think about kind of next steps. I will just say that, you know, the energy world, like the, you know, the buildings and transportation world is changing really dramatically. You heard Bruce talk about, you know, from horses to cars. As we look towards that new energy future, you know, we're in the middle of a transformation. And I think that having these kind of stakeholder processes or future studies, or at least the nimbleness of our policies to be able to adjust, I think is really important, because technologies will change, costs will decline, new technologies will come on. And I think, you know, having a process or having, you know, the coming change in our mind as we kind of move forward, I think is really important, that flexibility in our regulatory scheme or advancement in our regulatory scheme, I think are all things we should be thinking about. So I'm excited by the conversation and looking forward to diving in more.
Thanks, Dan. That's great. Before we wrap this up and take a break, Melanie, if you would like to react to some of the things you heard this morning in this panel, this is an opportunity to do that. Anything you'd like to add to this?
Sure. Thanks, David. You know, we've heard some really great approaches discussed this morning, and I just wanted to note that while the work of this council is focused, or a lot of this discussion has been focused on reduction of greenhouse gas emissions, it's important to remember that so many of the things we're talking about, reducing transportation emissions, reducing vehicle miles traveled, you know, generation of alternative fuels, not only reduces CO2 emissions, but emissions of other pollutants as well. And so we get the health benefits of reducing climate change, as well as the co-benefits of reducing those other pollutants that we're worried about. So, you know, we're talking about strategies that have much broader public benefit as well.
Thanks. Yes. Thanks, Melanie. Okay. I'll invite everybody to turn their camera back on just before we go to a break here. And so feel free to turn your camera back on. So what we're gonna do now is we're gonna take a break, and then we're gonna do some small group conversations. And let me say how that's gonna work. And this is important for all of you listening in as observers today too, how we're gonna handle this next 45 or 50 minutes. There's a lot to digest, and we know that one of the few ways we could actually start to digest things is having conversations with each other about it. And those conversations work better in smaller groups. So we're gonna take the Climate Council members and make some randomized groups of four folks and give you 35 minutes or 40 minutes to talk about how you hope you can focus this work over the next month and a half that we have left, month and a half, 2 months. So we're gonna do that and give the Climate Councilors some space to digest and reflect. The tech doesn't allow us to bring along our observers into those randomized four-person groups. So what we're gonna do is have our observers work on the very same questions that the Climate Council folks are gonna work on. And we've prepared a Google Form sort of survey mechanism for those of you observing today to do that. And we'll also provide some materials and some links that we think would be particularly relevant for you to dive into while the climate counselors are doing these quick small group conversations. There's some practicalities here. So let me walk through what's gonna happen. For those of you on the climate council, you're gonna see a link in the chat just shortly from Sophia, which will guide you to a new Zoom room where we'll be doing this work in small groups. And so what I'll ask you to do, and you can actually start doing it as soon as you see that link, is to click on that link and go into that room and just hang out for a second. And I'll be over in that room in just a moment and give you some idea how we're gonna work, and then we'll take a break and then go do those small group conversations. So for climate counselors, you can go ahead and click on that link and it'll say, do you want to leave this Zoom meeting and go into that one? And say, yes, please, I'd like to do that. So go ahead and do that. And if you are having trouble with it, we'll help you out. Now, folks who are listening in online, we're gonna take the next 45 minutes or so to go do this work in small groups. And for those of you listening, I'm going to put in on a slide in just in a moment in the chat. I don't want to confuse the counselors just yet. We're going to put in a mechanism for you to answer the very same questions that the counselors are going to be wrestling with in small groups. Okay, so attendees, we're going to take these 45 minutes. We're going to be back or 50 minutes, and we're going to be back around 11:20, 11:30 in this same space, this same webinar. And why don't Maggie, if you want to go ahead and throw up the slide on here that gives a little more information. And this slide has a couple things. Give me 1 second as it comes up. Sometimes it takes a little bit of time. Now, I'm also seeing some folks here in this Zoom room, left over Commissioner Heather Johnson, some others. And I invite you to come over into that other room or to just turn your camera off and your microphone off for the next 45 minutes and be back and join us in just a moment. All right, and Kate as well, Scott Brown, I invite you to click on that Zoom link or just simply turn off your camera and head into the other Zoom room. Okay, I'm seeing Maggie having some trouble with opening up that slide. Just give it one moment. Okay, we'll just give Maggie a moment to get her Zoom back up and running. Sarah, why don't you jump back over, jump in the other room? And Kate Dempsey, if you want to jump in the other room too, that would be great. And folks
who are working on it.
Yeah, okay, sorry. Let me know if I can be at all helpful. I know this is a frustrating thing.
It's not linking.
So if...
David, this is Evie DeFries from the Department of Labor. Mine's not jumping over.
Yeah, mine isn't either. I got booted off and then I'm not able to get in. But I got back in here, so that's good news.
Right, I can't seem to disconnect from this and I can't.
Yeah.
Okay, so my recommendation is you cut and paste the the link that's in the chat, and I can repost the link. And to you specifically, Kate, or to all.
Okay, let me see if I can do it now.
Cut and paste that link and then put it on some other document, like a Word document, and then we'll...
So weird as I'm like, spend my life on Zoom. This never happened.
So Maggie's okay. Gonna be here and is more capable than I.
All right, I think it's happening. I may lose.
Okay. I'm going to do the same thing and jump. Maggie, I'll leave you to it here if you want to share your screen. And if you could explain, we've still got 166 folks joining here as participants. If you could explain and put into the chat for everybody the Google form that we would encourage folks to use to answer those same questions. So thanks, everybody. We'll see you back here about 11:20, 11:30. And we will do all the substantive debrief here.
Okay, I hope that you can see the slide here. I'm going to drop these links in the chat to everybody as well, so you won't have to type them in or anything like that.
Am I in a room? I'm not sure where I am.
Hi, Representative Bloom. So right now you're in the main session, but this is going to be, everybody else is in rooms until 11:30. Would you like me to give you the link to join the rooms?
Yeah, I tried, but I got kicked out, so.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, I got booted out as well.
Okay, well, I will share the link in the panelist chat one more time. And if you're still having issues, you can just come back here and we'll troubleshoot. Hello all, welcome back to the main session. It's probably just gonna take a little bit for everybody else to trickle in here.
We're a little later than we thought. We had more technical challenges than we thought, and we're back. And I see we still have a significant number of observers joining us, and thanks everyone for hanging in there. We hope it was useful for you to do that Google Form survey. We hope that some of those resources we suggested were also helpful. There's a lot of reading to do. That's the reality for all of us in the Climate Council and observers. So taking the time to go through that primary source material is really helpful for all of us. Wow, okay, I think we're doing really well here. We're almost all over. I'm just gonna do a quick back channel Slack with Sophia to make sure nobody's lagging. Okay, so what we wanna do is just take a few moments and here in our main plenary room, have a quick shout out reflections of what really jumped out at you in having that conversation about how to focus our work and the key dilemmas we wanna sink our teeth into in the remaining time we have, which is sadly a month and a half, 2 months, and that's it. So let's just do a quick shout out. There's no order to this. There's no report out from the groups. It's just some things that are something that really jumped out at you. And Peter will take some notes on this for us. Go ahead if you want to raise hands or unmute yourself if you're sort of sick of Zoom telling you what to do. What are some things we really need to share in this full group about the reflections we had in that moment of digesting? Anything?
Well, I have one. I mean, Joyce did a wonderful job in our little breakout room. And one of the things that came up right at the end was that many of the groups had people who are complete experts in a field. And so they use words that that they know. It's jargon. It's like your doctor doesn't say your hip bone is connected to your thigh bone. I mean, they say something else. And so we had a couple of examples of that. And we just added that this whole report has to be written not for people who already know all these professions. I assume no one knows city planning, really, except kind of vaguely. If I say form-based zoning, they have no idea what I mean. And similarly, every group is like that. It's a shorthand among a group of people who all understand it. And that was true of transportation, is true of energy. And so just a little clear, that would clarify everything.
Thanks, Christina. That's really helpful advice. We appreciate that. I saw Andrew's hand up and I saw Ken's hand up. Andrew, go ahead, please. And then Sandy. Yeah.
Hi. Our group had, a number of conversations that intersected, and the intersection was really around some of the gaps that we saw. I think it came up most clearly in the transportation, where the gap, where we have an idea that if we adopt EVs at a certain rate and other things that we can meet our goal, but not really feeling like the plans that are put in place are like we have any confidence are likely to achieve that reduction. So there's a gap there. I think we also recognized a gap on the revenue side. And curious, and there was some discussion in our group about what the appetite is for generating revenue off of emissions in some way.
Thanks, Andrew. That's great. Ken Colburn.
Thanks, David. Keying off the revenue item, a lot of the recommendations, one way or another, will require money, and I think that it'd be good if the council can face that somehow affirmatively, so that there's less need for for policymakers that'll be charged with implementing some of the recommendations to choke hard initially. We're in a quest to save money versus that which will befall us. Let's say that and get on with it and be frank about it, as opposed to having it be the afterthought, the elephant in the room, et cetera. And then the second thought is just, and I mentioned this in our subgroup, the world has changed with respect to COVID in a number of respects. It's not clear yet if that's gonna be good or bad, but And we don't have a lot of time to analyze that before our report is due. But to the extent that we can get any insights from whatever knowledgeable sources about how transportation will be affected, about the importance of broadband, about, you know, energy use, et cetera, those would be helpful in making sure that our report stays timely and viable going forward. Thanks.
Thanks, Ken. Sandy Buck.
Thanks, David. This comes up in a number of places, but I just always want to try to emphasize that the importance of, in our quest to try to drive down emissions and adapt to climate change, that we're always looking for finding a balance between human need and our impacts on the land, as well as, and with those needs of the natural world. We've got natural climate solutions that are amazing opportunities to do both, to meet our human needs, but also respect and care for the natural world. And that's just the lens that I look at all this work through. Thanks.
Thanks, Dandy. Yeah, thanks so much. Anya?
Yeah, thanks, David. I'm hearing a lot about money and funding, which is obviously really important for all of these strategies. I think something that came up in our group that feels really important to me is that this draft strategy doesn't get us to our emissions reduction goals. And that would be a huge disappointment, especially for the constituency that I represent, young people and the next generations of Mainers, if we don't meet the goals that we set out to meet. And yeah, just wanted to highlight that and encourage everyone to just be bold and make sure that we, yeah, achieve the goals that we have set out to achieve.
Thanks, Anya. Representative Bloom.
Thank you. One of the things that Daniel in our group mentioned, I'm going to mention it for him and for us, was that broadband and access to broadband is extremely important to almost everything that we're trying to do in terms of reduction of CO2 emissions. So that that's just should be highlighted specifically. And that was one of the coming out of our group, that's one of the things that we said. And the other thing is about just some, I guess there were some specifics missing from, I felt, from the presentation, things like one of the recommendations of the Energy Committee was a consumer-owned utility strategy. That's an active and viable legislative action that we're trying to take. What's going to be, you know, where is that and is that hasn't been excluded, I hope. I have a feeling that it's part of the energy office's work. Is that correct?
Let's just a quick check in with Hannah and Dan Burgess on that particular issue of the state of switching to a state-owned utility. Is that part of the what's in that report, or Sarah Curran can also refer to that?
I'll let Dan or Melissa, I mean, I would say that the, Melissa, do you want to take that one? Not to put you on the spot.
Sure, yeah.
It is an incorporate, there's sort of a very broad question of a whole bunch of different funding questions and utility structure questions again, so I'll turn it to Melissa.
No, I think that's exactly right. The financing recommendation out of the Energy Working Group had some potential options to, you know, be investigated further. And so I would, you know, suggest taking a look at some of that language around what the subgroup that worked on that financing recommendation had proposed. But that was included in that package. And I don't know if Ken Colburn too had worked specifically on that group.
That Melissa's got it exactly right. It's one of the financing mechanisms, structures to reduce the cost of the energy infrastructure going forward. Green Bank was another one, for example. So they weren't called out by name, but the they're in the working group's documents. Thanks.
Are they going to be, are they going to be in the governor's energy group? Governor's energy report.
I think how specifically they're called out really hinges on our deliberations as the council at this point, right, Hannah?
Yeah, and just to be clear, Lydia, so there's sort of two things that you're referring to. I mean, one, we have an clean energy economy report, which is really how do we create good paying jobs, as many good paying jobs as we can in the energy sector? What are the challenges to that, whether they're workforce or other? And then I'd say separately, the Energy Committee reported out this power sector transformation, the need for a lot more study, which both Ken and Melissa just referred to. So that is, I mean, I think we are also cognizant that the specific effort around a publicly owned utility is an effort that's been being studied by the legislature. It got delayed by the fact the legislature has not yet returned. But it's a big idea that's on the table, sort of one of the many ideas to transform the power sector, but an idea that's receiving serious consideration. So it will continue to be played out. I think it's important for this group. There are quite a few big ideas that may or may not be played out by the time we're done in December. They will require additional process and study. And that's a big one where even the PUC and the legislature have said, all right, we need to spend more time on this one to really get to an answer that makes sense, because it's not a minor undertaking. So, and I think it's important this council continue to be engaged in hard and important questions, but we're also not going to solve all of them. I mean, I think Bruce Van Note would say we need to come up with a solution for transportation funding for big picture issues and for climate transportation initiatives. We're going to keep working on that. We hope to have some solutions as a part of this process. Are we going to solve all the hard questions by December 1? Probably not. So it's kind of a good area of hard study and decision-making for us.
Thank you. And finally, I just wanted to say about the cost-benefit analysis of all of these strategies. I haven't had a chance to get into it. I feel like that just reading all the stuff that we just got is going to be extremely important for us between now and whenever, because there's a lot of information there. And from a policy leader's point of view, as I am, that we really need to understand the cost and the benefits and the cost of doing nothing and be able to really communicate that well, because that's going to give us the selling points that we're going to need in order to get the policy initiatives passed in the next legislative session.
Thanks so much, Lydia. So we've got about a little less than 10 minutes. Let's just go down through those hands. Stephen, why don't you take it away, please?
Thank you. first, I appreciate Lydia's comments. Thank you for those. I'll just be real quick. I think one of the issues that I have with this is I feel a lot of the strategies that have been proposed do not require enough deep change within the structural, aspects of either the state government or the public. I think there's a lot of structural cultural changes that need to take place. And those are longer term strategies. And the investor-owned utility, I think, is a very viable one. I don't see how we can achieve improving our energy system if we don't create a more nimble energy grid, one that we can respond to as a public. I think we should be investigating that in concert with the legislator, whoever else wants to investigate it as well. I don't think it should just be waiting the ball being in another person's court. In terms of short-term strategies, you know, I really don't see many that are, that are really deployable other than expanding upon, energy efficiency within homes and businesses. I think that's a model that's already been created, and I think we should expand upon that. But other than that, I would encourage a lot more short-term strategies that don't necessarily require the huge cultural structural changes I referred to. Thank you.
Thanks, Stephen. Melissa?
Hi, yes, thank you. I would just say I agree with both Anya and Stephen that we need to be bold and we need some structural change to take place. But I also want to recognize, and this came up in our small group, just the challenge of behavioral change. You know, people are comfortable with the way their lives are, hopefully in a lot of ways. But it's just going to be really challenging to get people to adopt some of these new practices that we're discussing. And I think that Efficiency Maine has shown that with incentives, we can change people's ways. And so I think that incentives are going to be key. And of course, the issue of funding those incentives is a big one, but just recognizing that behavioral change is a huge, huge ask. And we've seen that, you know, as a result of the pandemic, it is possible for people to change their ways. So it's just a matter of kind of focusing on what behavioral changes in Mainers' lives are going to make the most impact, and how do we fund those, you know, those incentives that are needed there.
Thanks, Melissa. Matt Schlobaum.
Hi, everyone. Three concrete thoughts. One, I think some of this, like, transformations are most compelling when they're in some sense irresistible, right? And I think the economics of this, particularly in places struggling with deep inequalities in rural parts of our state, I think we would be wise to try to show the most tangible benefit while coupling that with the science and where we need to get to. And so I think this, like, jobs, economic development piece is critically important, and that we go big there, and that we think about it obviously in the clean energy sector, but what is, even if it's not an immediate strategy, what is a bolder transportation strategy where we think about the manufacturing of electric vehicles in Maine? You know, what is a buildings and infrastructure strategy? And obviously these things need federal partnership, and perhaps that's on the way, perhaps it's not, but I think the economic development, the job quality piece, the, like, those dimensions of this are critical to the underlying pieces. And I would just sort of push all of us to think about how we do that, and how we insert mechanisms to make sure that we're doing high road economic development, like strong, like, job quality standards, so we're not just creating any job. The second piece is I do think we have to be very clear-eyed and, like, grapple with the funding and the financing and the revenue questions. And again, of course, it begs the federal question, but we need scenario A and scenario B there. And it would be a great disservice to do all this work and then, like, have a menu of options that doesn't really allow implementation because of financing. So just grappling with that. And then I do think it behooves all of us to think about the cultural shift piece. On the one hand, we've seen the ease of that. On the other hand, if you take something as simple as the technology of masks, and how challenging that's been, it sort of makes the point of how hard this is. And I just think narratives that incorporate patriotism, that, like, sell the better quality lives we can live, and that, you know, invoke wartime mobilization in some sense. We can't do that alone from a state level, obviously, we need partners. But I think if we don't grapple seriously with that project, especially as it cuts across inequities, urban, rural, coastal, inland, north, south, by race, et cetera, we can't get where we need to go.
Thanks, Matt. Thanks so much. So let's do this. Let's end our meeting today. We're going to meet again next week. I'll ask Hannah perhaps to give us a few ideas about what's going to happen in the coming days and weeks, just some next steps. But in broad strokes, we will do a repeat of this next week, hopefully with less technological challenges. But Hannah, you want to talk to us about what's coming down the road?
Sure, yes. And I think on behalf of Melanie and I, thank you everybody for a couple hours of your time and really digging in. And I think the small group conversations, and just for the public to clarify, those were conversations of 3 to 5 people. So we're just trying to really get people have a chance to interact and start talking. But I think those and this conversation really, they start to, you see the debates that we're gonna have. How do we push harder, but how do we make it manageable? I think Melissa and Matt's comments right at the end are really applicable, both how do we make it relevant to people's lives, but how do we build this kind of momentum, and momentum especially as it relates to economic development, that will make these things doable. So thank you again all for just your honesty, but you know, we're digging in and it's going to get a lot more dug in. That being said, so next week's Climate Council meeting is sort of a repeat of the same thing, but on the adaptation and resiliency side. So we sort of have the first three groups of strategies that we talked about, and next week will be the next four strategies that will be more on the side of helping Mainers adapt to the challenges of climate change. We'll get into the work that came out of the Resilience Supergroup, the Natural and Working Lands Group, as well as the Coastal Marine Group. So a lot of big ideas that we've put together into strategies that we'll talk about next week, and we'll do sort of a similar format of having staff kind of over give you an overview of the high level strategies that we've now put in these new, I like to call them buckets, but then talk about what the cost benefit analysis told us, what the cost of doing nothing report has told us, what the public has said about these issues, and then dig into some similar conversation. So that's September. Again, as Sarah mentioned, we're gonna have a couple of separate conversations for Climate Council, as well as the public members, to hear about the equity report, to hear about the science and technical report, and another one that I've already forgot, some of the modeling analysis. So lots more, but I think as Lydia said, you've got a lot of reading in front of you. Please take the time again to read at least the framework and the executive summary of some of those reports, because I do think it's important. There are a lot of decisions on our plate coming up in the next couple months. But again, we thank you greatly for 3 hours of your time. Sorry for some Zoom glitches. I saw a new version of Zoom today, so I feel your pain, Kate Dempsey. I've never seen before, but we do appreciate everyone sticking with us. So thanks, and I'll just pass it back to David for any other last goodbye.
I will only add to say that I see 71 responses from the observers who've been with us today to that questionnaire we sent out, which is the exact same questions we've been dealing with the key dilemmas. So we will summarize that and push that back to you next week, and as a way of incorporating that thinking into our conversations as well. Thanks, everybody. It's the top of the hour. We'll see you next week. We will do this again. We really appreciate everybody hanging in there. It's a tough way to run meetings, but I think we're going to hang in there and make some really powerful decisions for the state of Maine. So we'll see you next week. Take care. Reach out to me or anybody else if you have questions or concerns about how things are going. Have a great day. Take care, folks.